Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Anybody want some Kiora?
Butter-kissed. Remember that?
Butter-kissed, yes.
When Mandy Mays meets Blondie Butter, wham, it's butter-kissed. On sale at the kiosk now. Oh. I can't believe I can remember these things. That's terrible. Anyway, look, good evening, and welcome to another edition of Word in Your Ear. Now, we are clearly entering another golden age of the music movie. This year alone, we've had Marianne and Leonard, we've had The Making of Motown, we've had Scorsese's Dylan, we've had Rocket Man, we've had Bohemian Rhapsody, which, of course, you will remember because it has a sensational cameo by a sort of Timmy Mallett lookalike who plays the part of David Hepworth at Live Aid. Unforgettable. And there are more big music movies lined up for 2020. And this started a conversation between the three of us about which are favourite rock movie of the past would be, and also whether or not Oliver Stone's The Doors is literally the worst rock movie ever made. Yeah. To be decided, I don't know. And we thought we'd ask the great man to come in and help us continue this debate. You know him, he's an old pal of the podcast, was here talking about his Billy Bragg book recently. He's the film editor of the Radio Times. He presents a fantastic classic FM show called Saturday Night at the Movies. Nobody's seen more films. Nobody's eaten more popcorn. Please welcome and let us present, in fact, Andrew Collins choosing the 10 best rock movies of all time.
Well, there you go.
And there it is. Now, what we decided to do was... No expense spared. We decided to put them in categories because we thought it was impossible, didn't we, to say, yeah, let's have a biopic or a fiction being measured against, I don't know, a tour film or a concert film. So explain the categories that we've got. These are the ones you've chosen.
First of all, did anybody else, when they first saw the word biopic, think it was a biopic?
Yes, I did.
I did,
biopic.
A surgical...
It's a procedure.
Yeah, biopic, yeah.
I always did. Anyway, now we know it's biopic, which is a kind of, Hollywood Reporter kind of thing, a biopic. So, yeah, biopics, profiles, exactly the same, really, but you'll see that it works. Tragedies, again, the same as the biopics and the profiles, but more tragic. Tour films, fairly self-explanatory. Concert films, just like tour films. Comebacks, that's quite different. Jazz films, that's quite different. Fiction, so is that. Festivals, just like concert films and tour films, and oddities, because not everything fits into concert films and tour films.
So before we go any further, can you remember the first time you saw at the cinema a film that would be regarded as a kind of pop film or a rock film or whatever?
It would have been Grease, 1978, mm-hmm, which was all the kids at school went to see Grease. And I remember coming out of Grease, and it was so clichéd, I didn't even realise I was living a cliché. I sort of came out and thought that I was Danny Zuko, in the same way that an earlier generation had come out of Bruce Lee films thinking they could do karate. And so I walked home with my friend Dave, and we walked home, and while we walked home, I was doing this with my hair, which, of course, there was nothing in it, so it just fell back down to a bowl cut. But I was kind of doing that all the way home, and that was my first time of being, living through vicariously through a rock film. I didn't know that it was set in the past.
Oh, really?
Well, oh, right.
I thought that's what America was like, and I was kind of right. It kind of was, but still a bit like that, wasn't it?
Right, yeah.
So anyway, yeah. So Grease really got me.
What about you, Mark? What was yours?
God, first rock film. I don't know. Would it be Woodstock, or is that ridiculous? No, it was something before that.
You must have. Well, it's Hard Day's Night and things like that.
Oh, Hard Day's Night. Of course. Yes. Sorry, no, the Beatles films. No, absolutely. Yeah. It was Hard Day's Night.
But they redesigned the music film because they were made to be cheap things for the kids that you know, the industry didn't think
they were made to be done quickly above all, weren't they?
Yeah. You know, Hard Day's Night,
they made it black and white because they didn't have time to make it in colour.
Yeah. Incredible. First ever kind of music video, really. That scene on the train, isn't there a scene on the train where they suddenly just start playing kind of imaginary instruments? Or just
and with those weird stringy kind of overhead lockers that they used
to have. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah, beautiful. I mean, you know, I wasn't able to see that at the same time, so Grease kind of did for me what would have happened to me if I'd been a little older.
Yeah. What was yours, Dave?
I probably going to see it at the Ossett Palladium in 1950. It was on Talking Pictures TV recently, which of course I watch devotedly nowadays.
So we could do that.
Sorry, sidebar.
That's the age we are.
Sidebar, I noticed that Ginger Baker, who passed away last week, was apparently a devoted viewer of Talking Pictures TV.
Yeah.
It was the idea that the former drummer of the Queen, of Cream, spends his twilight days sitting there watching Kenneth Moore films.
Yeah.
You know, on Talking Pictures TV. I thought it was rather sweet, actually.
It's lovely. I love the fact that Kenneth Moore's surname is now so relevant because there are so many Kenneth Moore films. How many more films can there be?
So I think the first one I saw was a Tommy Steele film called The Duke Wore Jeans. Truly terrible.
Oh, okay.
And I saw it again recently and I can confirm it's just as terrible as it was in my
mind. I'll tell you what it's not as terrible as. It's not as terrible as... I've never seen it, but it's not as terrible as The Doors by Oliver Stone. So you think, to celebrate the films...
We're all agreed on this.
Yeah, we're going to celebrate at record speed, but we have to address The Doors film by Oliver Stone.
It's got to be dealt with first.
Yeah,
before
I think... I'm assuming a lot of people in the world have seen The Doors film.
Has anybody seen it?
You've seen it, 1991. Just out of curiosity, if you like The Doors, I love The Doors music, you've got to see it. Well, it was easily the worst, I think, music film. And I can prove it just by reading back some of the actual words that were in the screenplay and were thus said by two actors on the screen in a massive, huge, expensive film. They're on Venice Beach. One of them is Jim Morrison, played by Val Kilmer, who is a man, even though he's got a female name. And Ray Manzarek, played by Kyle MacLachlan, who was most famous at the time for being in Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
So they're Jim and Ray. They're sitting on the beach. And these are the exact words. I haven't changed any of these. In fact, they have to be exactly as they were written because these were passed by all sorts of people before they were allowed to be made into a film. So, what you've been doing, says Ray to Jim. Jim says, oh, writing songs. And then Ray says, let me hear one. And Jim says, I'm shy and I can't sing. And then Ray says, because I'm sure this is exactly how it happened, you've got to sing better than Dylan, man. Johnny's in the basement mixing up the medicine. He does an impression of Dylan. Let me hear your words. Jim gets his notebook out on the beach, fumbles with it a bit, then sings, let's swim to the moon, let's climb through the tide. Then he really gets into it. Park beside the ocean on our Moonlight Drive. He's just written the lyrics to Moonlight Drive, the future Doors song. Ray looks serious. He's impressed, though, and there was a massive pause, huge pause. Some great fucking lyrics, man, he says. You write this? Because he's in his notebook. He says, Jim says, I got a whole concert in my head. I bet he said, I bet he really said that. What happened to you in the desert, man? Says Ray. Let's get a rock and roll band together and make $1 million. He actually says that. He actually says that in the film. It gets worse because then they'd start talking about what they're going to be together when they make this band. Vietnam is out there, man, says Ray. Sides are being chosen. The planet's screaming for change, Morrison. We've got to make the myths.
Sorry, was that a line? The planet's screaming for change?
This is all coming out of the mouth of Ray Manzarek. We should call ourselves Dionysus, man. Then he changes his mind straight away. I've got a name. You've already given one. Now he's going to give another one. The Doors. He says, the doors of your mind. And then, in case any of us are slow, the Huxley book. The quote's from William Blake, actually. Now, if that doesn't suck the marrow out of your bones, just hearing that.
It's also wrong, isn't it? It's the doors of perception.
The quote's from William Blake, actually. Yeah. Anyway, that's the worst.
Well, there's a scene where they compose and record Light My Fire in about 2 minutes, don't they? And it ends with kind of, we're headed for the bright lights, guys. You know, it's that kind of thing. It's shocking.
We're going to the toppermost of the poppermost.
So come on,
so that's
biopics.
How bad it is.
Biopics. Sorry.
Biopics. We've all been in and had one. I've chosen in no particular order. I think Lady Sings the Blues is worth thinking about, 1972, partly because it's a Motown-produced film starring Diana Ross, who actually turned out to be a pretty good actress, and did a great job in this film. She also was in Mahogany, which is about the fashion industry. Didn't quite suit her, that one, I don't think. But nevertheless, Berry Gordy produced this, and usually Berry Gordy produced it. It would have to be some kind of shrine to Berry Gordy, but he's actually not in it because it was done, you know, before he was Berry Gordy. Yeah.
Well, he was having an affair with Diana Ross at the same time.
Well, yeah, of course it was his girlfriend, yeah. But nevertheless, I think it came out very well. People were very surprised how good Diana Ross was. Why certain singers become good actors is, well, it's certainly not mathematically easy to work out beforehand, but she did a really good job. Although Time magazine said that the film squandered one of America's most natural resources, Diana Ross. That's what it said. So, you know, everyone's a bloody critic.
Does it have the actual the death of Billie Holiday at the end, the kind of where she's chained to the bed and the drug squad of dies of surrender?
They don't. They're not squeamish about the whole, you know, because whole, you know.
I've not seen it, so.
Yeah, it's good. Okay. And it's by Sidney J. Fury, the director. Walk the Line is the same, basically the same as Ray Charles. This one's about Johnny Cash. That there are standard things that you have to do, especially in an American biopic, which is be born poor, obviously. If not black, then certainly dirt poor. And there's a kind of solid, approachable way that these things are done. And if you like the music of Ray Charles and you like the music of Johnny Cash, then you're going to go home happy. But I think this is nicely done in the sense that it tells us, in a way, how little you sometimes have to do when the story is as good as a lot of the great stories. So, yeah,
and
Reese
Witherspoon, fantastic.
Reese Witherspoon, fantastic. Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. Control, I like Control. This is the obviously, I'm sure many of you know, the Ian Curtis biopic. And, of course, it's in black and white, and it looks like some photographs by Anton Corbijn have been animated, and that's pretty much what it is. But I think it's very good. Kevin Cummins, the other photographer of Raincoated Men at the time, must have been fucking furious that Anton Corbijn became a filmmaker before he did, because, you know, effectively that era was photographed by Kevin Cummins and Anton Corbijn, but Corbijn, your old mate, he got in there first as a film director. I think this is also one that you have to consider at the same time as 24-Hour Party People, which is the kind of comedy version of the same kind of period. Hard to do a comedy about the death of Ian Curtis, but it is in there. And I think together they make a nice pair. Love and Mercy has a casting problem. The Beach Boys story, the first half, Paul Dano, or is it Dano? Never can be sure. But Paul Dano, he actually looks a lot like Brian Wilson. And then in the second half of the film, where he's a bit older, he's played by John Cusack, who's a great actor, but looks nothing like.
No.
And so it's like, who's this other
bloke? Stone tooth.
Yeah, who's this man?
Yeah, what happened to Brian Wilson?
He's had some terrible accident, and they've had to make him look. Yeah, anyway, so there's a kind of, hot and cold, that one, but I think worthy. The first half, I think, or should be just sort of maybe just removed from the second half. And one of my favourites of recent times is Straight Outta Compton.
So that's your winner in this category.
Well, I would consider it my winner because I think, this is basically the same as Johnny Cash or, any of the other biopics. It's about a band, effectively, as we would used to call them, but it's effectively the rap version of Johnny Cash, and did a really good job on it. But the great thing, that's the most important thing about it, to me anyway, is this. And obviously, they swear a bit sometimes, the rappers, and... MC Ren, who is a founder member of these great people, he doesn't get much screen time. I mean, MC Ren is not the most famous member.
Oh, then complained about it bitterly, didn't he?
He complained about it. And he complained about it on Twitter, which is where you have to complain about things. Yeah. And he said this, and I'm going to just quote it because I like to quote it. He says, this is MC Ren, "Man, fuck these bitches. Universal Pictures, leaving me out of the movie trailers. When you have bitches working on a hip-hop film that you don't know shit about hip-hop, this is what happens. How the hell do you leave me out?" he says. And he kind of calmed down. He hadn't seen the film at this point.
And then he sees the film.
Yeah. And he goes to see it. When he goes to see it, and this is his next tweet by the same man. "Congrats to the cast and crew. Great job at telling the story." That's so sweet, isn't it?
Strong work, guys.
Yeah. That is... Oh, MC Ren there.
That's brilliant.
A Bohemian Rhapsody I've put in here as well, because it is just good fun. Do you not think that is all that matters about that film, Bohemian Rhapsody? Because I think people are a bit snooty about it. Another biopic. But Rami Malek is brilliant in it.
And had some hilarious lines. That line which says something, I can't let anyone compromise my vision.
I know.
But
brilliant. That's why I think it's just good fun.
Yeah.
But I would go for Straight Outta Compton, because I think people would assume that that would be hard work to sell, especially as one of them develops HIV towards the end, and you know it's got this kind of tragedy bit sewn in. Brilliantly done, I think, and deserved all of the applause.
That's your best biopic.
Biopic.
So now we're on profiles.
Yeah, profiles, which are just that little bit more focused, aren't they? Because they're usually done when somebody's died, and that's, you know. Not in the case of David Bowie, though. I put Cracked Actor in first, which is an omnibus profile by Alan Yentob. And it's around the time of Diamond Dogs, and Bowie is famously living off cocaine and milk. They're his two main foodstuffs. And we see him in the back of a limo. It's all the stuff in the limo is brilliant.
And finds a fly in the milk.
He finds a fly in his milk. And that's a great thing for a start, because he says, oh, look, it's a foreign body. He says he describes himself as a foreign body in America because he's in L.A. They're driving through the canyon somewhere, and they come back into L.A. And he's in the back of the cab there, and it's dark now. He was quite happy when he was out in the desert. He says, look, there's a sign for a wax museum. He said, who'd open a bleeding wax museum in the middle of the desert? He's a brilliant raconteur, really funny. And then they get back into the city, and they're in L.A., and it's dark, and there's a police siren in the bit where Yentob is about to ask him some more important questions. And he says here, there's a siren, and he says, I hope we're not stopped. He says, is there anything behind us? And then he sniffs. It's brilliant. It's like punctuation, sort of nose punctuation. I hope we're not stopped. Is there anyone behind us? And then just perfectly on cue. And it's just magic. So I would say, just for that bit alone, Cracked Actor is absolutely brilliant. There have been others. Again, after people have gone, George Harrison, Living in the Material World, which is about 6 or 7 hours, isn't it?
Fantastic.
It's really long.
Fantastic.
It's absolutely just everything that you could possibly want to know ever.
All his
him.
Gangs, his big mates with the guys down the pub, he's got his petrol heads, hasn't he? It's
brilliant. He just invites people to come and do his garden. He's just brilliant, George Harrison. So, you know, if he is your favourite Beatle, then you obviously have to see this. Marley as well. I enjoyed Marley by Kevin MacDonald.
Yeah.
It's not that it has stuff in you haven't seen. There are some photos, I think, from Bob Marley's final gig in Pittsburgh. There were no moving footage of it, I don't think, but he got hold of some still photographs, so there's kind of stuff that you haven't seen before. And his end, again, it's sad, but his end is really important. You know, how he died and how, you know, he just couldn't... He had to have his dreads cut off towards the end when he was hospitalised, which had cancer all through his body. And he was obviously devastated that he couldn't have his dreads. I mean, that's massively important. But it's just he just could not carry them around. Can you imagine how weak he must have been towards the end? Mm-hmm. So it kind of obviously ends badly, but it's moving. It's very moving stuff. And then Quincy, I picked Quincy quite recent. It's on Netflix. It's just the story of Quincy Jones, who is an ungracious bastard.
He is, isn't he?
Yeah. He did interviews to promote this when it was on Netflix, basically. And he actually said this. He decided to have a pop at the Beatles.
He has a pop at everyone.
Yeah, he does.
He said they were the worst musicians in the world. He worked with them once, I think, I think he worked with Ringo on one album. Anyway, he called them no-playing motherfuckers. Not trying to swear. These people are swearing. I'm just quoting it back. But no-playing motherfuckers, suggesting they don't play the Beatles because they're no-playing.
McCartney's the worst bass player. He got lots of publicity out of it, didn't he?
Brilliant publicity. I mean, it's a great documentary because he's a living legend and he's still going and he has a bit of...
Did he have a coma at one point?
Yeah,
he comes around from a coma and they say to him, who's the president?
Yeah.
And he says, Sarah Palin. She's hilarious.
Yeah.
She's obviously perfectly all right. You know?
It's pretty good. A good guess.
Yeah, it was.
He didn't know how long he'd been out.
Yeah.
So Quincy's worth looking at. If you've got Netflix, you've probably watched it already. Of those, I will stick with Cracked Actor.
Right.
Because I think it is absolutely unique. And also made while he was still alive and still absolutely on the money. And because of that...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just gorgeous. So tragedy next.
Tragedy is the next
category. All tragic, really, in some ways. I put one on here because you told me to. I haven't seen it, and I want to see it, so I'll just be completely honest about that, which is Janice, Little Girl Blue.
Oh, Janice is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell me why it's...
Well, my theory about Janice is that in everybody's life story, particularly musicians, there's a pivotal moment. There's one moment upon which everything turns.
Had that not happened, they wouldn't be the person that they become.
Right.
And in her case, it's really, really sad. She's at college, isn't she? Or she's at school? No, she's at college. And she is voted ugliest man on campus.
Oh, yes.
I mean, that is the cruelest man. I mean, oh, it's awful. Yeah. And the whole film is about revenge, really. Mm-hmm. That isn't too... I'm not being unkind.
No,
it's about proving to all these people that she's going to be absolutely fantastic and successful. And there's a key moment in the second half. Do you remember this? When she goes back to her old school.
Oh, yeah.
There's a school reunion.
She insists
she
on going.
She goes back, and she goes back with two... not one, but two incredibly good-looking blokes on her arm with a feather boa and just basically yes now okay who's laughing, you know, that kind of thing.
Don Simpson
it's
that.
A bit sad, but it's an amazing film. Incredible film.
Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer, the bad boys of Hollywood producers at the time. Anyway, Don Simpson decided he would go back to his high school reunion after he'd become one of the biggest producers in Hollywood. Just dropped in by helicopter in the middle of the lawn outside, kind of got out, walked around a bit, sniffed probably, and got back in the helicopter.
Yes, sniffed,
went off again. Got it. Fuck you.
Left in a hail of eggs.
Where's your helicopter landing? Tragedy is Amy Winehouse.
Oh, and, incredible film.
It's tragic because it was made by Asif Kapadia, a documentarian of great note, who had done Senna, the motor racing film, which was brilliant. And I care not about motor racing. I'd walk out of the room if it was on. And he made me interested in motor racing. And so he knows his way around a car wreck, and in some ways, Amy was a car wreck. And I think that he kind of treated those subjects. They both kind of had death wishes, you know, the motor racing driver and sometimes the singer. And there's stuff that breaks your heart about Amy is the early footage they've got for when she's very young. I mean, just talented then, and lots of filming going on. And then towards the end, when her health is obviously going, and her dad becomes this... absolute, I will call him a nuisance. You know,
it turns up with the film crew when she's on holiday in the Caribbean.
Yeah, exactly. That she's trying to get better, and she's stick thin, and you know, actually somewhere where there aren't cameras. And he brings a bloody camera crew out with him. There's a certain amount of accidental, let's call it parental, kind of harm there, I think. So that's brilliant.
And the bit where she's carried unconscious from her house, put in the car and taken to the airport and driven to her last gig, it's just appalling.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
Whitney also is a good one, I think. Of the two Whitney films that came out one after the other, this is the good one in the sense that it has most access to her family, Kevin MacDonald, again. And we find out that she was abused as a very young child by a child. It's her cousin. It's very strange, and it all comes out, and the cousin's now... dead, so it can't be proved one way or the other. But that's kind of shocking. And you mentioned Marianne and Leonard. Only just seen this. This has only just come out. I don't have a great relationship with Leonard Cohen. I like some things, but I don't know that much about him. So I found it very interesting. But what a wanker he is! he's on this beautiful island, this Greek island, with this lovely Norwegian woman. He's got a kid and they're having a great time, and then he finishes writing his magnum opus and decides he's going to be a singer and put his poems to music and just goes off to tour and become famous, which he did.
And the level of promiscuity.
Yeah, a different lady every night,
ridiculous.
At least. Yeah. So and yet he came back to the island occasionally, and the times that he came back to the island you see in this film are kind of get shorter and shorter in the fiscal year. He squeezes her into a month and then hops it back out to have his way with the groupie.
It should be said there's a brilliant moment when he's in the Chelsea Hotel, and he runs into Janis Joplin, who's looking to sleep with Kris Kristofferson. And she says, "Who are you looking for?" She says, "I'm looking for Kris Kristofferson." She says, "I am Kris Kristofferson." Which is brilliant, isn't it?
That is absolutely brilliant.
You've got to give him some points for
that. I would definitely give him some points. But it's a fascinating documentary, and also tragic because Marianne dies and he sends a message to her. And, you know, they get word out to Leonard wherever he is now, and he's not well either. David Bowie. it's a sad ending, but at the same time very moving. I won't ruin it by giving any more details.
So what are the best rock films? Are they the sad ones or the happy ones?
Well, I mean, I
sad ones are kind of easier, aren't they, really? Because everything in the film, a sad biopic, if somebody dies, everything's poignant, isn't it?
It's true.
Absolutely everything from the beginning.
Yeah, and I mean, you definitely get that from Marianne and Leonard. And I've added in Being Frank, the Chris Seavey story, Frank Sidebottom, to those who don't know. Chris, as he was 54 when he died, had so much bad luck. I think he almost had a hit, didn't he? He's one of those people. It would have been in smash hits at the time. I'm in love with the girl from the Manchester megastore. Check
the
out
freshies.
This. Yeah, the freshies. But they had to take the virgin part out because obviously that's a trade name. So they had to re-record the song. And in re-recording the song, despite having lots of success, let's say, in Column Inches, they'd wasted all their money because he made them go back and redo it, not just cut out the virgin, but actually re-record it all. And it cost so much, it was his big chance, and he blew it. But then he became Frank Sidebottom and had a second life as a children's entertainer, effectively. And everyone loved him. And when he died, much too early, people just crowdfunded his funeral. And a statue was erected to him, all because of the people who loved him so much. So that's a kind of sad but ultimately very happy film. And I can't remember which one I chose. Oh, Amy, really. I think Amy is just...
So Amy. Amy's a favourite tragedy.
Yeah, I think it is. Because it makes you sad just to think about it.
So the next category is tour films.
Tour films, which are very different to concert films because they go from one venue to another. Don't Look Back. Don't Look Back is kind of, I think, untouchable. I mean, would you agree? I mean, it's just...
Absolutely
to catch somebody at a particular time, whether you were around at the time, aware of Dylan at the time, I wasn't, and to see this kind of candid sort of... And he seems to be playing up for the cameras a bit, doesn't he? In it?
Oh, yeah, a lot.
You know, he's saying he's being really horrible. Who's he? Really horrible to somebody in it, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a journalist. Yeah.
That's right.
Well, and Donovan.
Yeah. So
all sorts of people. Alan Price.
He's putting it on, but he's being really entertaining. And the fact that it's, you know, I think that it is a brilliant thing. And,
but also you see every single aspect of it, don't you? The camera follows him on stage when he goes on stage at the Albert Hall. Yeah. It watches him writing songs. It watches him talking to various girls afterwards, the fans. Yeah. Everything, and after that, you never really heard him speak again. It's really interesting. He obviously maybe...
Yes, it's true.
You just never... I can't think of a time that there's been a movie where he said anything.
Or seen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cheap shot. So, I mean, you know, I will say, I think Don't Look Back is kind of untouchable in this section, but we must mention Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. Talk about the best gig you could have, or pair of gigs you could have possibly been asked to go and film. There it is. Very rare that something amazing happens in a performer's career in front of you. So the people who were there anyway at Hammersmith Odeon must have had a hell of a night because they were sad and happy at the same time because they were seeing Bowie and then finding out he was... And they're all crying outside, aren't they? Fantastic footage they always show of that young Bowie fan. She goes, they go, what's so great about him? And she says, he's just smashing.
Yeah.
You know, all rock critics giving their notebooks.
Because I recently talked to somebody who went to that gig.
Really?
Because the beauty of that gig was that you could turn up on the day and you could buy tickets at the box office.
Try telling that to the kids today.
Like 15 bob or whatever.
I know. I remember In Bed with Madonna very fondly when you first saw it because her relationship with Warren Beatty is so weird, isn't it? Because he's too old anyway, and there's something weird. They've done a film together, haven't they, Dick Tracy? So there's a bit of that. But then they arrive in Japan at the start of this amazing tour, the Blonde Ambition tour. So we've got amazing access. The dancers are there. You definitely get backstage and in amongst it. And she doesn't seem to say to the camera people to stop filming at any point. And they arrive in Japan at the rainy season, the one that's ruining the sport at the moment. So why anyone books anything, whether it's a bloody sporting tournament...
Rugby.
That's the sport, isn't it? Yes. Yeah, I knew it was one with big blokes in.
Yeah.
But then why would you book up a tour to begin in Japan, in Tokyo, knowing that it's going to be pissing down with rain? And they're all cold. All the dancers are really cold. They have to wear special coats when they're on stage. So I find it a fascinating look into the backstage of a massive tour. I mean, not just a band playing, but a huge, huge event. I do really enjoy that. Oh, and the police turn up in a kind of crappy attempt to do a Jim Morrison on her because she simulates masturbation. Oh.
In Canada.
Yeah,
isn't
you don't need to do
she's
one.
She's so unlikable.
Yeah, I know.
With Kevin Costner when she kind of indicates how repulsive he is, and it loses her the part in The Bodyguard, doesn't it?
Kevin Costner. She says, "What did you think of the show?" or something afterwards, and he said, "It was neat."
Yeah.
Such a crap thing to say.
Yeah.
He's nice, though, Kevin Costner. So the Beatles 8 days a week I like as well, because it's just another way of slicing the Beatles cake.
Fabulous.
You think there wasn't another way to do it. But Ron Howard and his incredible researchers, let's be honest, credit them for getting testimony from people like Whoopi Goldberg and that. I think that's a great film. And there is some restored footage in it, isn't there? Which is always sweet if they do that. And I picked Rolling Thunder Review because I'm not a lifelong Dylan fan. And also, unlike Ray Manzarek, I don't think his voice is a laughing matter. But at the same time, this is a bizarre thing if you're on the outside of Dylan world. And I learned a lot about Dylan while working at Q from John Baldy, who was just the most educated man about Dylan in the world. I was very lucky to be there at the same time as him. But I still found it hard to get into what the hell this is. This Martin Scorsese, it's called The Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese, which is a bit grand, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, for a start, I like Martin Scorsese. Conjuring the Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese, depending on which territory you see it in. And it's a pseudo-documentary. It's really hard to explain. Explain it in two lines. Because it's a weird fiction
fiction. I've got a theory about this. My theory is that he thought, I can't make this film unless I've interviewed Dylan. So he started by interviewing Dylan.
Yeah.
And Dylan, has everybody seen this film? I'm sure you have this. Of course, it's been on
Netflix. It begins, doesn't
and,
it?
Yeah, and Dylan just makes up a film director. Yeah. Called, it's called Van Dorf or something. Isn't it? He said, oh, a strange guy. He sometimes used to have other people's lunch. You know, three lunches. And he'd just make up this nonsense. And all about how Sharon Stone had joined the tour when she was 17 and did all the ironing, you know. And having said all this, and he made up like a promoter who just didn't exist, did he?
Yeah.
He said that he got his white face mask idea from Kiss. He'd been to see Kiss in the club. And so, obviously, he then had to make a film that actually backed up what Dylan had said. And had to have an actor actually acting the part of this fictional guy Van Dorf. It's incredibly complicated.
Points for audacity.
I know, it's really brilliant.
And I still don't quite understand it, but I do know that I was kind of transfixed while watching it. So from that list, though, Don't Look Back, we'll just accept Don't Look Back.
Yeah.
It's got to be the best tour film.
Concert
film, slightly different, obviously, because you can't go too far from one venue if it's concert film. I think The Last Waltz is an obvious one, 1978. They're not a band that I have a massively long intimate relationship with, but the stuff that you hear when you listen to this, The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, amazing. The Waits, of course, the Staple Singers are on. It's just a beautiful. They don't need much description, these films. If you've seen The Last Waltz, and I bet a load of people in here have, you just know what I'm talking about. It's just immense. Stop Making Sense, completely different. Talking Heads trying to kind of, you know, on MasterChef, and they say they're doing they're deconstructing an apple crumble, which means there'll be a bit of crumble there and a bit of apple there, and then a tiny little leaf in the middle. That's kind of what Talking Heads were doing, but without, you know, with actually some content. And I haven't seen it for a long time, but it starts with an empty stage, doesn't it? And then David Byrne comes on with a normal suit.
With a
cassette
blaster.
Player down, and starts playing. I think that plays the drum beat. Then the band come on one at a time. It's so simple. It's amazing that it hadn't
incredible
been done before, but it really hadn't been done before. And the band are about as good as they ever were, I think. I mean, just incredible. So I love that. I think everyone does, don't they? And it was the big suit film.
The big suit.
What a brilliant idea. The reason he had the big suit was because he wanted his head to look smaller, and he couldn't think of a better way of doing it other than having a big suit, which is fair logic, you must admit. The Buena Vista Social Club, another one that kind of doesn't really need selling, I don't think. Old Geezers Jamming, which is, you know, that's almost a genre of its own, isn't it?
Right.
I saw this film, Inner the Yard, which is a load of old geezers in Jamaica getting back together and playing, which is just...
But it also starts with Ibrahim Ferrer's kind of shining shoes, isn't he?
Yeah.
One of them's working in a Havana cigar factory.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of down on their luck. And they finish up at the Carnegie Hall, so it's got that amazing ascent throughout it.
Excellent. And this will always go on, I'm sure. There'll be an indie band getting back together sometime in the next 10 years.
Can I make my one...
And they'll be as old-seeming as the Buena Vista Social.
Can I make my one boring film critic observation about why Last Waltz, I think, is really good?
Yes, please.
It's because he shoots the whole thing where you see two or three musicians in every shot. Mm,
yeah.
It's never individual. And I don't know if I'm the only person who feels this, but watching bands, what's interesting is to watch them watching each other.
Yes.
It's the interreaction.
Yeah.
The dynamic.
Is he going to get it right? Has he gone on too long or whatever?
Yeah.
And he captures that absolutely perfectly. in the last waltz.
Well, you can't really beat it, I don't think. So should we do comebacks?
Oh, yep. Yes, comebacks.
Go on.
Comebacks. Well, they're all self-explanatory in a way. I mean, Elvis, the 68 comeback special, which, you know, shouldn't be brilliant, but is absolutely brilliant. It's kind of, you know it's going to go all right, but until he just gets the audience right there, and it's such an artificial setting, it should be awful. It should be like, you know, Seaside Special. But it's just not. It's absolutely incredible. He is, well, it's maybe his peak before he really went into a decline.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do love watching that, and I will watch that quite a lot. Spinal Tap. This is Spinal Tap. Is a comeback film, you know, par excellence. And I don't need to tell you how good it is, but let's not forget that when the Boston gig is cancelled, Ian Faith, the manager, says, don't worry about it, it's not a big college town.
Not a big college town. But it's also, it's the way they calibrate their general decline by watching the seats empty.
Oh, God, yeah.
It's just heartbreaking.
And he says, we're not less popular, it's just our appeal is becoming more selective.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Full of stuff like that, isn't it? Anyway, so that sells itself, I think. But Metallica did it in real life. Some Kind of Monster is this, where they don't call him a therapist, they call him something else. Oh, a performance enhancement coach. Because they all hate each other, and the bassist has been replaced because he has literally had a head-banging injury. Jason, you said he banged his head too much and they had to leave the band. So they'd lost the bassist, and James Hetfield goes in to rehab in the middle of making the album, which became Saint Anger. It's classic stuff. It's almost like a parody of a rock band being in therapy. But it's brilliant, and you kind of want them to get it at the end. You can't help but like them. They do make a record, and it is called Saint Anger, and it is really hard to listen to, but the film's good. So the film is the good thing that came out of that album. Anvil. The story of Anvil.
Wonderful.
Who were the real-life Spinal Tap, the
wonderful
Canadian
film.
Rock band who are seen playing, I think, on the same stage as Bon Jovi and the Scorpions at the beginning. They're part of that wave. And then it doesn't happen for them. It happens for all the other bands, but not them. They're from Canada, and they go back to Canada, basically.
It's really... it's never unkind about
it's
them.
No, really, it's a really affectionate film, yeah. Affectionately made, and the guy who made it, who directed it, is a massive fan of the band. So yeah. He was kind of, I can't believe you're letting me make a film about you, even though no one else has heard of it.
And the lead singer is delivering school meals, isn't he?
That's exactly right, yes.
Yeah. So going back on the road. Yeah.
He's doing something more useful, perhaps, than even in a band.
Yeah.
And then they go on a European tour, and it's just like Spinal Tap. And they miss their trains, and they get lost in Prague, and it's brilliantly funny. And then at the end, don't want to ruin it for you, but they get a gig, a Transylvanian rock concert, Transylvania Monsters of Rock, it's called, and it is in Transylvania. And they go to this concert, and they think this is it. They think they're going to get their Spinal Tap gig at the end, and they're on at 11:35 a.m.
Yeah.
That's like, if you're at Glastonbury, that's before the brass band.
It is. Yeah, it is.
And 170 people come. 174 people turn up. There's thousands should be there. Anyway, it's a wrong time of day to be on. But you love them. You just love them. You want them to succeed.
Yeah, it's a brilliant film.
And I've also put in Blue Note Records. No, that's jazz. Say it, let's not ruin it.
All right. Yeah. So you're a winner in this category.
Yeah, it's a tough one, but... I'm going back through my notes now.
I'll tell you what
comebacks.
It is.
Comebacks.
We've got a slide of it.
Hey, you've got a slide
we'll
of it.
We'll tell you.
Is it Bross?
It's Bross.
Bross.
Yeah.
Bross.
What
really,
a great film.
It shouldn't be so good, but it is so good. Because you think you've got them, you think you've got it, you know what it's going to happen, and it isn't how you think it's going to be. I mean, two brothers in a band is dangerous. And there they are. They don't really like each other. One of them is still the drummer, which is a really bizarre thing. It was always bizarre, even when they first came about. That the two twins, one of them was sat behind a drum kit, obviously on a good riser, and obviously shot more on Top of the Pops than most drummers get. But nevertheless, they are both good looking, and one of them sat down, and he's still sitting down. I think that is the problem all the way through it. You don't need to be a psychologist to work out what's going on. One gets to stand at the front, the other one gets to sit down. So the one at the front is slightly jealous because he doesn't get to sit down. The one at the back is pissed off because no one can see how shapely his calves are. And so it is a recipe for disaster, but you love them both so
and
much.
Full
so
of,
much
oh, yeah.
love for these two. Whether you like their music or not, it's a great story.
He talks about London, he says something like, the Embankment, Black Cabs, Big Ben. There's isn't it?
I know. They are like little kids. Like
they, don't you think with that film's a classic case, though, of, I thought this as I watched it, all rock documentaries, you can make them two ways. You can either make them reverential or you can make them satirical. And you use entirely the same footage to do it.
Yeah, just the way you. Just
it's
the way
just the point of view of the filmmaker is look at these pillocks.
Yeah.
Or it's look at these amazing people.
I know.
Same people.
And I think most people would have gone in thinking it'd be one way and came out thinking the opposite, which is so nice. It's completely swerves, doesn't it, in the middle. So we love that. That's definitely the winner of the comeback category. Jazz films.
Jazz.
Yeah, I might just change the order of these. That's a jazz joke. God, I didn't even write it down. It's not even written on it. Now, of all of the films that we're talking about, this is the only one that I watched yesterday for the probably the second time or third time. Jazz on a Summer's Day, 1959.
I watched it yesterday as well.
Do I want to be at that?
It's
on
YouTube, people.
Yeah, I watched it yesterday,
it's
too.
It's pretty good quality, actually. You can watch it, you know, on a laptop, definitely, without any problem. The music's superb. And, you know, you don't have to like jazz to want to be there. You
and was made in what, 1958
or something? 1958.
Incredible.
And, it was Newport.
Shot by two, not in Wales.
No.
I always thought Bob Dylan did his. Did
Newport County.
Yeah, I know. Nothing wrong with Newport in Wales. There were two photographers, I think, the directors, that was there. And one of them, I think, was worked at a record company. Anyway, they went there, fashion photographer, one of them, and just got it. They just got it. The stuff was there for the taking. But they it's not one where it's only about an hour and 20 minutes long, which obviously for a 3-day is quite a concertina version of it. But the stuff they leave in makes you want to see even more.
It's like a giant lifestyle movie.
It looks like a Marlboro commercial.
Yeah, but it's like a commercial.
I don't think not everyone who can have been at that needed to wear glasses, but everybody's got glasses.
Yes.
So I think you had to have them. Maybe you got them on the way in.
And the women have got headscarves.
Yeah,
women headscarves.
And they are having a great time without getting up off their deck chairs.
they're all in little folding chairs.
You know, just sort of slightly jogging about. It's absolutely brilliant. That is the way jazz was obviously meant to be appreciated. And it's like a holiday camp or something, you know, or in a park with a bandstand and everyone sits in deck chairs. It just looks like the best thing ever. And Louis Armstrong. He's on stage. It's one of the indoor ones, I think, and he's telling an anecdote to the host, the MC. And I've watched it a few times. I've no idea what he's talking about, but I know he met the Pope. But I don't know what the anecdote is. He's so excited and laughing all the time. He's such a happy chap that you cannot hear what he's saying. So I've no idea what the anecdote. If you watch it and you've seen it and you know what that anecdote's about, tell me, because it's got to be good. It's got the Pope in it. So, yeah, unbelievable. The others in this category have got a lot of work to do. I saw the Glenn Miller story when I was a boy, a teenager, which was very strange. I just hit that point in my life where I decided I needed to see every film that had ever been made. So whatever film came on, I watched it and then wrote it down in my diary. And I saw the Glenn Miller story in about 1982 or something, and I really enjoyed it because it's got James Stewart in it, which is, you know... Where did I see somebody saying James Stewart was a bad actor? And it was on John Oliver's show that he does on Sky Atlantic. And they were talking about James Stewart and saying he's a terrible actor.
No, he's not.
Bollocks.
It's James Stewart.
He's Glenn Miller when he wants to be. He's a cowboy when he wants to be. So, the Glenn Miller story, because I like it. Why not? I also like What Happened, Miss Simone, which is a much more recent story, clearly about Nina Simone. And her story is so interesting. You'd have to really be a poor documentarian to capture it. In fact, she hops it to Liberia and becomes an activist. And
and has a very complicated husband who's very against her civil rights activism.
That's right.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, what a nice husband he is.
Yeah, a very difficult man.
So that's what happened.
So anyway, our winner in that category, and anybody can go home tonight and watch it, is Jazz on
Summer. It's on YouTube.
It's too
fantastic.
Good. Yeah, absolutely brilliant.
So next one's fiction.
Yeah, it's harder to do this fiction, obviously, for self-evident reasons. Because it is a fiction, it's made up. But at the same time, how much does it soak up the time and you know what people were thinking? American Graffiti is George Lucas's equivalent of My Diary with all the films in. He was doing the things that young people did in Modesto, California, which was basically drive around in cars. And if you weren't old enough to have a car or didn't have a license, somebody else slightly older than you. I used to have a friend who was a couple of years older than me who had a car. It's fucking brilliant when that happens. So I could understand American Graffiti, even though it was set in the past. and Wolfman Jack is in it. The first time I'd really seen a DJ portrayed on film, and it was really him. And he really is a Wolfman, apparently. The captions, that's it, the captions at the end.
Yes.
Yeah.
That, I don't know whether that was the first time that was done, but it was certainly the first time it was done on such a big scale, where all the characters you'd learn to love, and you do learn to love them all, it tells you what happened to them. One of them is AWOL or missing in action Vietnam. It's heart-rending stuff.
And that, also, it's just the story of one night, and so that's really captivating. And when the dawn breaks and they have the drag race,
that's right,
out of town, you feel you've been up all night with them. It's astonishing,
superb.
And what's the music on the drag race? I'll tell you what it is: Green Onions, Booker T and the MGs.
Is it?
Which is a piece of music that you can put in any scene in any film, and it always works. Yeah. It either looks threatening or it looks fun. You know, it enhances any scene that's put in.
That's brilliant. Music supervisor, David Hepburn.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Simple as that. Green Onion. You're done. So the winner in this category.
Yeah, beating Stardust, beating The Commitments, which I love because of the thing about the Irish.
Beating The Commitments?
I love the Commitments. It is just...
We've got that as your winner.
That is my favourite because of the joy of it.
Dave hates this film.
Do you?
I loathe this film.
The bit where he says the Irish are the blacks of Europe and Dubliners are the blacks of Ireland and Northside Dubliners are the blacks of Dublin. So say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. That is... I mean, whether that was written by Roddy Doyle, I guess it might have been, or by Dick Clement and Ian Lefrenet, who did a kind of polish on it. Bloody excellent script. And they're good players as well. High Fidelity, you told me to put in, but it doesn't really quite match up with The Commitments, I don't think.
High Fidelity is a great film.
Yeah.
For its the way it portrays life in a record shop, the snobbishness of the Jack Black character.
Yeah.
When the guy comes in, he wants to buy
Stevie Wonder. I just called to say I love you.
He goes, "Is he for his daughter? Is she in a coma?" That's right.
That is a film for blokes of a certain age, isn't it?
So we got two categories left.
Yeah, festivals is easy to do in a way because they all speak for themselves. Monterey Pop is... What I like about Monterey Pop is it's over a couple of days and you get the sense of the time passing because no one quite knew what it was going to be like on the first day. And then things happen on the second day and I think Janis Joplin gets signed by Columbia somewhere between the first day and the second day. It's amazing to sort of live that through the film. It's not long enough for my liking, but it's fantastic. And there are longer versions of it. Gimme Shelter, we were talking about earlier on, is a horror film, really, seriously. I mean, I didn't know, when I saw it for the first time, I didn't know what Altamont was all about and what was going to happen. So when Unfortunate Punter, Meredith Hunter, it's just, it makes me chill.
Well, there's a bit where you get to see, I think, Mick Jagger, I think Charlie, watching the footage
of the
Hell's Angels murdering a member of the audience. And you think, are they feeling guilt? Because in a way, Altamont was a kind of free concert to make the finale for the film they were making. Yeah. That's why they did it. And they had no security. They wanted it to be cooler than Woodstock. There was no security apart from the Hell's Angels. It was complete chaos.
Yeah.
And you kind of think they're partly to blame in some ways.
In some ways,
Don't you miss the days that Hell's Angels were, you know, security?
Yeah, I know.
The Stranglers used to have the Hell's Angels doing their security.
Well, Trump has them now, doesn't he?
Oh, God, yes.
No, sorry to bring the whole
party
down.
No higher recommendation.
Woodstock, also good, again, you know, many days would have been good for that.
But I suppose part of the reason Monterey Pop was good is similar to the reason Jazz on a Summer's Day is good, is that it isn't crowded with people.
Yeah.
Whereas every other festival film subsequently is overrun with people. So it's about the scale of the thing.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at, like, Glastonbury Fair, the film made about the first Glastonbury by David Putnam, that's really charming because there ain't many people there.
There aren't many people there.
It's true. I will not go to a festival unless I get a seat as good as this. You know. Not anymore.
I'm similar.
Also, if you haven't seen Fyre, F-Y-R-E, it's on Netflix.
Oh, yes.
The documentary about the awful festival that was never going to happen was invented by some crazy guy who wanted to basically promote his app and had loads of influencers to say how great it was going to be. In
social media meets the festival.
If you haven't seen Fyre, F-Y-R-E, you've got to see that. And then the final category is oddities.
Oddities.
Oddities are just things that don't really fit. Slade in Flame It's Mark Kermode's favourite film, I think, of all time.
Oh, yes, it is.
Yeah, I think so. After The Exorcist, obviously. it's great. It's such a...
What a contrast.
Of all the bands you would think would be able to act, you might not think it was Slade, but they're really good. Actually, Noddy is pretty good. Jim is good also. When they're talking about... And they're in the pigeon loft talking. It's actually really good naturalistic acting. I think, you know, they really should be credited, I think, for that. Rude Boy, meanwhile, which, as a Clash fan, there's plenty in that to enjoy, but not the acting of Ray Gange, who plays the roadie. He's a non-actor. I think he says it on his card, non-actor. And he's so bad in it. I mean, it's not his fault. But there's some really terrifying stuff in there
it's
as well.
It's not his fault.
It's not his fault. You know, he kind of... I think they sent him on tour to do a bit of roadieing for a week, and that was his qualification to be in it. But there's a terrible National Front demo in there. Awful stuff going on. You think it happens now. It was worse then, by the looks of it, to me. It's a bit where Topperhead and the drummer is just... He's trying to talk to him in the dressing room. And Topper's just trying to talk to the tour manager, Johnny, isn't it? And he says, Joe's lending me his towel. He says, Joe's lending me his towel. Just ruins the Clash, doesn't it? The idea that Joe's got a towel. I mean, and it's his
and
towel.
And he's nice enough to lend it to people.
And Topper is
That's
saying,
wrong.
I'm going to use Joe's towel. Yeah. He said, it's okay. It's just, I love little, sweet little moments like that.
Yeah.
So, Slade in Flame is just unbeatable, I think.
And of all of those, out of those ten,
I think it's
in a kind of desert island moment. What would you choose?
I think it's Cracked Actor. Now, it's partly because David Bowie's gone, and there will never be the full and frank David Bowie interview or the full and frank David Bowie autobiography. There's a load of stuff we're never going to get, and in some ways that's good. And we, I think, all very pleased that he didn't have to live through the years that have occurred since he died. They have not been good years, and he never saw them. Which I'm very pleased about. And he appears not to want... I mean, there is going to be a biopic of David Bowie. With Johnny Flynn, I think.
Oh, yes,
the actor, Carson, he was a musician. So, you know, he doesn't look unlike him. But a part of me doesn't want David Bowie to be immortalised. I don't mind Freddie Mercury being immortalised because he's a kind of larger-than-life figure. But David Bowie, I don't know. I'm kind of unsure about that.
Do you think there'll be a Beatles one?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was No Way Boy, wasn't there?
Of course, yes.
Sam Taylor Wood.
Well, very good, too.
Yeah, and I really think the guys who played the band were pretty good.
They were
I think
great.
You need, the clue with a good biopic of a band is, can the drummer mime the drums?
Yeah.
And, or play even better. And that's why I think Control, there was a good drummer in Control as Stephen Morris, who's a pretty tight drummer. Hard to do if you're not a drummer. And the guy who played him, I can't even remember his name, something like Jim Pinnock or something, he has one IMDb listing and it is playing Stephen Morris in that film, so I suggest that he's probably a drummer rather than an actor, and it makes all the difference.
So, as in real life, so in drama, it's all about the drummer.
To me, everything is about drumming, yeah.
Andrew Collins, ladies and
gentlemen. What can you say?
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.